I'm Brad Linder, and this is Newsworks Tonight. Dave Heller's off this evening. Today, the U.S. Department of Justice announced it'll work with police in Chester, Pennsylvania, to help build trust with residents. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports the partnership comes after a number of police-involved shootings that prompted community outrage.
In February, Chester police pursued 33-year-old Shalimar Longer into a residential neighborhood and unleashed nearly 100 rounds into his vehicle, killing him. Police-involved shootings like this one are too common in Chester and the United States, says Mayor Thaddeus Kirkland.
I've watched a lot of news reports and law enforcement engagement or involvement. It always ended in a very tragic way.
Sworn into office in January, Kirkland promised to bring in the Department of Justice to shape up the police department. Noble Ray, with the Justice Department's Community-Oriented Policing Division, explains exactly what they'll look at.
Those officer-involved shootings, community-oriented policing, building trust, training and employee development, data collection, and crime analysis.
The federal government will pay for the two-year process, which starts with an outside assessment and a list of recommendations, followed by periodic check-ins as to whether Chester police are taking the suggestions. Making changes based on the recommendations is completely voluntary, but Chester Police Commissioner Darren Alston says he'll do it.
We're going to follow as to what the recommendations are.
Does that mean that you'll be changing police department policy?
If need be, yes.
The first step in bridging that trust gap with police will come on June 16th, when the Department of Justice will hold a listening session with residents. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Education advocates across Pennsylvania are celebrating the fact that the state's about to commit to a new student-weighted formula for distributing state aid. But not everyone's happy. As Keystone Crossroads' Kevin McCory reports, one advocacy group says proceeding as planned will continue to shortchange many school districts.
For the past few weeks, Kelly Lewis has been crisscrossing the state, trying to help certain school districts understand just how unfairly they've been treated by the state for the past 25 years. At an Irish bar on the main drag in Wilkes-Barre, he spoke to a smattering of parents and business leaders.
And what happened is school districts that saw population increases, like the Poconos, Pocono Mountain, East Stroudsburg, Stroudsburg, they grew tremendously over the last 25 years. They didn't get one red cent for the additional students. City school districts saw poverty levels go up tremendously. They didn't get one red cent for an increase in poverty.
Lewis is a former Republican state rep from the Pocono Mountain area. He's now chairing an organization called Citizens for Fair School Funding. With the exception of a few years under Governor Rendell, since 1992, the state has not had a systematic formula for dividing state education money that actually acknowledges changes in enrollment. This week, though, a major breakthrough came that was lauded by the lion's share of advocates. Governor Wolf and the General Assembly came to an agreement on a new formula that will count actual enrollment, plus a number of other factors, including student poverty, local tax effort, and district sparsity. When Lewis's group ran the entire pot of state education aid through that formula, it saw in real numbers what many have known for a long time. Not counting those factors has really hurt some schools.
That formula, black and white, recognizes that some school districts are vastly underfunded, and we believe that they should be made whole. That's called fairness, that's called being human, that's called trying to fix a broken system.
A Keystone Crossroads analysis found that moving forward, 156 of the state's 500 districts would see increases if all state money were run through the new formula. City school districts with stable enrollment would get huge boosts in that plan. Philadelphia would receive the biggest, followed by Reading, Allentown, York, Lancaster, and Erie. Wilkes-Barre is not far behind that.
I just got so sick of reading about it that I had to come out and, like, literally see what these people are saying.
Christina Solomon is a Wilkes-Barre parent who came to Lewis's meeting the night after the school board there voted to lay off dozens of teachers and make programming cuts. The presentation got her fired up about the districts that have benefited over the years by not seeing funding drop even when enrollment decreased.
I understand they have problems too, and they're afraid that this will happen to them, but it has to be equal. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me.
The cuts in Wilkes-Barre were driven by a $4 million budget gap. If all money went through the formula, it would receive an added $25 million next year. But no one, not even Lewis's group, is advocating for all funding to go through the formula. That would essentially suck the money out of many other districts, leaving them decimated. Largely based on enrollment declines, Pittsburgh would lose about $67 million. Altoona would lose about $13 million. Instead, lawmakers intend to apply the formula only to new money. If enough comes online, that will help ease inequities over time. Over 50 advocacy groups have come together to call for $400 million increases annually for 8 years.
But that assumes, I think, terribly unrealistic expectations as to the amount of overall education funding that will be granted.
Erie Superintendent Jay Badams testified before the House Education Committee this week. The structural budget deficit in Erie is forcing leaders to contemplate sending high school students to other nearby districts for the betterment of the kids. Even if advocates get the money they seek, Badams says it will still take too long for the formula to really make a difference.
This is like a person who's dying of thirst in the desert being promised a gallon of water, but being given that water one drop a day. You know the result. There's no way that person would survive.
He agrees with the plan that Lewis's group has outlined, which would give 75% of any new money to the districts that the formula says have been most shortchanged. Outside of Lewis, a handful of lawmakers, and a few superintendents, that plan has gotten zero traction among influential advocates.
All we're saying is that we're all in need.
Eric Esbach, superintendent of the Northern York Area School District, also testified in the House this week. He's also a top official of the Pennsylvania Association of School Administrators. He says the formula as written was not meant to determine who's been underfunded. That can only be done by setting a benchmark for what adequate funding means, which the commissioners who wrote the formula specifically refused to do.
PASA believes that except for a handful, school districts do not have sufficient resources to provide the programs and services necessary to support every student to meet or exceed state-mandated levels of achievement.
The politics underlying this debate can't be ignored. The statewide advocates have members from districts across the Commonwealth, and more have something to lose than gain in Lewis's plan. And legislative leaders on both sides of the aisle also represent more districts that would fare worse in that deal. But there's no two ways to slice it. The plan, as agreed to by lawmakers, is asking the neediest districts in the state to wait longer for equitable funding. Keystone Crossroads, Kevin McCrory.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide initiative reporting on the challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the initiative. New Jersey lawmakers have approved a plan that would give Atlantic City 5 months to come up with a plan to reduce expenses and balance its budget to avoid a state takeover. The bill next goes to Governor Chris Christie for approval. This week, the American Civil Liberties Union of New Jersey sent a letter to lawmakers warning that the proposal raises constitutional and civil rights concerns. Rebecca Livingood is an attorney with New Jersey ACLU. Thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
So Atlantic City's having trouble paying its bills. Governor Christie wants the state to step in and take over management of the city. Why does the ACLU think that's a problem?
Well, the takeover that the bill contemplates would really allow for total state control of all municipal government functions. So it extends beyond those functions that are strictly necessary for financial recovery and would allow the state to undo any action by the mayor or by the city council. So our concern is that the right to vote is fundamental, and in New Jersey, that includes the right to elect local officials, and this would really entirely undo that ability.
Now, state officials are elected too, and at least some small number of representatives in the state legislature are elected by the local community. But what you're saying here is essentially the people who vote for city council, they vote for the mayor of Atlantic City, they're voting for jobs that no longer matter as much under this proposal.
Exactly. The authority of the local elected officials would be under state takeover entirely at the behest of the state. And so they would have no power that the state could not undo. The problem with that, though state officials are elected, is that state officials are elected by all residents in New Jersey. And, so the governor, for example, who appoints the officials who would have authority under the takeover is elected by all New Jersey residents rather than Atlantic City residents. And so we've seen, for example, in Michigan, where the emergency manager legislation has allowed for state takeover of local municipalities, that those state decisions then are not subject to local control.
And so we're not just talking about the issue of geography, of local versus state representatives, but in this case, we're also talking about demographics. The the makeup, the population of Atlantic City doesn't necessarily reflect the rest of the state. So the people making the decisions might not look like the people living in the city, right?
Absolutely. And that is significant in two ways. So one, the takeover bill focuses on the fiscal health of Atlantic City. So it is, by its terms, limited to municipalities whose property tax income revenues had declined by 50% and whose debt had increased by 50% as of the end of 2015. So that is only Atlantic City. And so it targets low-income communities. And then it also targets communities of color in that Atlantic City is over 80% residents of color compared to about 40% statewide.
So what's the alternative? I mean, obviously, Atlantic City has had a lot of financial difficulties in recent year with casinos closing down and increased competition for its one of the primary sources of revenue in the community. If the state doesn't come in and do a takeover like this, then how else is Atlantic City going to survive?
There's no question that some state aid may be necessary, but the aid does not need to be tied to this condition of absolute takeover of all city functions. A narrower version of state intervention would allow some fiscal assistance and oversight without undoing the ability of local representatives to make any decisions at all.
And it wasn't really touched on in this week's letter, but I know another issue that the ACLU has been concerned about is the effect of a state takeover on unions. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, it is our understanding that this takeover would allow the state to renegotiate collective bargaining agreements, to really undo any protections for unions that the state wanted to, those decisions that were previously available under local control. I think it is very concerning in an era of increased pressure against unionization to have those decisions being made by an undemocratic authority, I think is very troubling.
Would the ACLU consider taking legal action if this plan is adopted?
So at this point, we are not considering legal action. However, part of the goal of letting lawmakers know about our concerns at this stage was to try to alleviate them so that legal action isn't necessary. In Michigan, a number of groups, including the ACLU of Michigan and the Center for Constitutional Rights, are currently in litigation about the emergency manager bill. And we believe that many of their claims are meritorious. And so it is not inconceivable that there would be similar claims against New Jersey, but our goal is really to avert the need for that litigation, and we currently don't have plans to sue.
Rebecca Livingood is an attorney with the New Jersey ACLU. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Still ahead, business is picking up for a local resident who impersonates a familiar political figure.
You have to do the laugh, first of all. So it's like, you know, ha, 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 ha.
That's coming up as NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Brad Linder, in for Dave Heller. In our region, the upcoming Memorial Day weekend serves as an unofficial start of the summer season, and with that, thoughts turn to the Jersey Shore. Justin Osiello runs Jersey Shore Hurricane News and writes the Down the Shore blog at newsworks.org, and he joins us via Skype to talk beach season. Justin, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Hi, Brad. Thanks for having me.
This afternoon, the New Jersey Assembly and Senate approved a measure to ban smoking on public beaches and parks. The bill now goes to Governor Chris Christie, who vetoed an earlier attempt 2 years ago, saying local communities should make their own decisions. If the governor signs the bill this time, what does that mean for people visiting the shore?
It's really not going to mean a lot at this point because the bill will not go into effect until 180 days after passage. However, going to the future, the beaches will have an option to provide a smoking section. This will be an across-the-board ban throughout all the municipalities in the state. And I'll add to that, from some of the commenting on JSHN, on Georgia Hurricane News, there are a lot of people who are not happy about this. Even non-smokers are saying, I think this is another example of the state trying to trample in on our individual rights. So we'll see what happens.
And as things stand right now, are there some places that already have smoking bans, regardless of state action?
Oh yeah, there are communities up and down the coast. There are at least a dozen communities from Monmouth County down to Cape May County. If you smoke there, they have their own ordinances, and you could certainly face a fine.
So, what condition are the beaches in right now?
Well, generally speaking, overall the beaches are fine. Each year there's been improvement from Sandy. Obviously, Sandy took a tremendous toll on our beaches, and since Sandy, a lot of communities have seen beach replenishment by the Army Corps of Engineers. But there are some beaches that are struggling a bit, and there was a report issued recently by the New Jersey Sea Grant Consortium. It says that New Jersey beaches took a pounding last winter from two major storms. There was a storm in early October and a storm in late January, in addition to a succession of similar, less severe disturbances. And you know what? Those disturbances in some places have resulted in significant erosion. And that's always bad news when the beaches are trying to recover. One thing I'll add to that, though, is that that's only a minority of the beaches. And I have not heard of any beach closures for the season. So you'll be able to still go to your favorite beach. Your beach may be a little more narrow than typical, but we now have a few months of the beaches to naturally replenish. So even if there isn't beach replenishment in your community, Mother Nature will come through for us this summer, and beaches will naturally expand as the sandbars that are currently offshore come back onshore as we head into the summer.
While Memorial Day might be the start of the beach season, temperatures have been in the 80s and 90s this week. It kind of feels like summer already.
The switch to summer just really turned on yesterday like that. We had it went from early spring right to summer. So it's hot and humid. The National Weather Service is forecasting similar conditions through Sunday. So, you know, sunny conditions, hazy, hot, humid. By Monday, could be a threat of some showers and thunderstorms, more than likely on Monday than the other days. But forecasters are saying that there could be a spot shower or thunderstorm all weekend. Whenever you have heat and humidity, there's always that chance.
Justin Osiello writes the Down the Shore blog for Newsworks.org. Justin, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you so much.
They say imitation is the highest form of flattery. For one South Jersey woman, it's also inspired a political conversation. WHYY's Katie Culinary encountered celebrity impersonator Holly Ferris at a recent rally for presidential candidate Hillary Clinton in Camden County.
You have to do the laugh, first of all. So it's like, you know, ha, 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 ha.
Sicklerville, New Jersey resident Holly Ferris has been working extra hard on that laugh these days. Sitting front row in the bleachers at the Camden County College gym, you probably wouldn't guess Ferris was fresh from Las Vegas, where she impersonates Hillary Clinton, Tina Turner, and others for a living.
Pretty much if they're over 50 or dead, they're in my repertoire. And Hillary, I started doing her in LA, and I did it as a goof. But now,
did somebody say to you, like, oh, you look like Hillary?
No, I don't look like anyone I do. It's all makeup and paint. But, you know, I can do the voice and tell you how I've always been friends with Donald Trump. I read his book, but it stopped on chapter 11.
For the record, the real-life Clinton insists she's never been friends with Trump. After Clinton lost in 2008, Ferris hung up her Hillary wig and focused on her more popular impersonations like Cher and Joan Rivers. Then last year, the former Secretary of State announced she was running for president again. Now, Ferris has a Clinton gig about once a week, with more requests coming every day. That means keeping a close watch on the candidate's changing hairstyles. Ferris says she's had her new Hillary wig recoiffed 3 times in the last 6 months. Trust me, she's got the look down. But Ferris also has to listen carefully to not just what Clinton says, but how she says it.
I DVR absolutely everything that she does, whether she's on The View or whether she has a debate, you know, and she's back and forth with the 2% of the 3% of the 5% of the 6%, you know. And then I look at different expressions, how she moves her hands all the time. She's got a slight lisp, which I just kind of realized.
Ferris has also realized something else. When she first started impersonating Clinton 8 years ago, she was an Obama supporter.
When I saw that she had a real possibility to win this time, I started really working on Hillary. And in working on her and researching her, I fell in love with her.
So what changed? Farris says she's learned more about Clinton's background in advocating for women and children and about her experience as Secretary of State.
It's very hard for me to do her and be condescending when I do her because I am so pro-Hillary now.
Still, she's not above making a few cracks about Bill Clinton's infamous infidelity.
I was at the first uprising for Egypt, and I was able to deflate that uprising, and Bill says if anyone could deflate an uprising, it's me.
It's the kind of dig that taps into what many people don't like about Clinton, the established political power couple she's part of, and their brushes with scandal. But while she may be a Clinton supporter, Farris is first and foremost an entertainer. She wants to get laughs, though she admits it would be great to keep the gigs coming for another 8 years. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Each year, more than 200,000 U.S. military members make the sometimes rocky transition from active duty to civilian life. On tomorrow's show, as we begin the Memorial Day weekend, we'll hear about an effort that's underway in Wilmington to make the change easier. Thanks for joining us. I'm Brad Linder for Newsworks Tonight.